From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. And this is a live Lake Effect Informed Voter Special, unpacking the midterm elections, presented in collaboration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Today, we're at the Collectivo back room on Milwaukee's east side with a studio audience and a roundtable of guests. We're going to take an in-depth look at the results of yesterday's elections, both here in Wisconsin and around the country, and ask what the implications are for all of us in the next 2 years.
With us this morning are several reporters from the Journal Sentinel who covered the elections not just yesterday, but in the weeks and months leading up to Election Day. We'll also be joined by news analyst and former state legislator Mordecai Lee, who will help us make sense of the results.
And we'll be taking some of your questions that came in through the Informed Voter Texting Club.
It's a Lake Effect Informed Voter Special, unpacking the midterm elections, and it comes your way right after this update from NPR News. WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin has a new governor today, most likely. Democrat Tony Evers was declared the winner of the governor's race around 1:30 this morning, defeating incumbent Scott Walker and denying him a third term.
The race was decided as about 45,000 absentee and early votes in Milwaukee County were counted and went overwhelmingly for Tony Evers. As of this moment that we're recording, Evers leads by a little more than a percentage point, about 36,000 votes, which would place it outside the realm of a recount.
So today, it's an informed voter special, live from the Collectivo back room with our partners at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about yesterday's results and looking ahead to what they mean in the next 2 years.
Joining us for the first part of our conversation are Dan Bice and Mary Spacuzza. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
We might be a little bit punch drunk since we were both at about 3 o'clock in the morning still at the office.
Are you still actually hitting the refresh button in your mind?
Sort of, yes.
I guess we have to start with these ballots that were counted very late in the evening in Milwaukee County. And you all were really on top of that story from the moment it became evident that there were these votes out there. What do we know about the vote counting process that led to the point that suddenly there were these 45,000 ballots that were out there?
Actually, we first wrote about the 45,000 ballots. It's between 45 and 47,000 ballots around 4 o'clock. Saying it was out there, but there was no indication that they were waiting till the end of the day to count those. Mary knows a little bit more about the process.
So what happened was when Neil Albrecht from the Election Commission gave his 4 p.m. update, he mentioned that there had been about 45,000 or so absentee ballots. He said they started counting those at 7 a.m. However, as we were watching the results, we have a talented coworker who's going to be up here soon, Craig Gilbert, who really knows his vote totals and was saying these totals aren't adding up. What is going on in Milwaukee County? Why is it saying 99% of precincts
reporting? It takes a lot to get Craig worked up.
He was worked up.
That's how serious it was.
He was on fire.
And then someone sent me a note saying that there were about 50,000 votes uncounted. Mm-hmm. So we called the county and the county says, yep, that's true.
Well, and the city, interestingly enough, said that they, that they had started counting them at 7 a.m., but they clearly had not been included in the tally or reported to the county. So we didn't realize at that time that that meant we were going to be in the office until 3 a.m. But, the governor's, his campaign team last night pointed to concerns about damaged ballots or reconstructed ballots.
Right, so what does that mean?
I mean, that can mean any number of things. That raises a lot of questions. So clearly, when there are concerns about damaged ballots, that's something we take really seriously. We played phone tag with the City of Milwaukee Election Commissioner in the early morning hours and hounded him enough. He did issue a statement first thing this morning saying that of the about 47,000 or so absentee ballots, that there were approximately 2,000 that were damaged and reconstructed. He said that could be ones that were damaged by, like, the envelope. If it gets the adhesive on it, they reconstruct them to avoid, I guess, corrupting the machine.
Well, and give me a brief definition of reconstructed in this case. They physically look at the ballot and have to ascertain what the person's intent was?
Well, another example he gave is somebody marking an X instead of filling in the little circle, and that's not going to get read by the machine, so they will have, I mean, they're supposed to, there are clear rules they're supposed to follow, and they said they did. I'm sure we will hear from election observers if they did not, but they said they followed that process and essentially, you know, filled in the circle looking at the, or reconstructed the ballots that maybe had adhesive on them.
But the important thing is the number.
2,000.
We're talking about 2,000, which even if all of those get excluded, and we assume most of them were for Evers, we're still outside the number for a recount.
So the recount is unlikely to be triggered.
You know, based on the law that was passed by Republicans, it's outside that 1%, unless there's some more ballots that are, you know, I don't know, military.
Well, I posted a tweet that Scott Walker did in November of 2016, in which he's very critical of someone wanting a recount in the presidential race, saying 22,000 vote difference between Trump and Hillary Clinton was much too wide to trigger a recount.
Right, this is when Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, basically paid for a recount with that 22,000 vote margin. Let's talk a little bit about what led to those recount rule changes. I mean, this was, you know, you mentioned the Governor Walker tweet, and in the wake of all that, the Wisconsin legislature changed the law.
Mm-hmm. What is the support?
Right, with Walker's support. So what does the recount law look like now? So.
I think, first of all, the candidates have to pay for it. The state no longer does that for them. And the recounts, you can have a recount if there's a difference up to 1% between the two sides. And right now the difference is at 1.1%.
Lynn from Milwaukee sent in a question about absentee ballots, and she wanted to know, when a precinct has reported results, does that count the absentee ballots? I mean, are they assuming that that's in there? When we see those, you know, such and such precinct is reporting 28% this way or 97% that way.
I'd have to check with the Election Commission to see how they did it last night. It was our understanding that those absentee ballots were being counted and delivered separately from individual precincts, but I don't want to misspeak on that.
So one thing that's important to note, I do a list of winners and losers, and actually the list is probably being published as we speak. And on that, I have the Milwaukee City election officials as a loser, because this same thing happened in 2016. We got the results, and then everybody had to sit and wait to see how the city numbers came out. It looks like what they do is they count the ballots throughout the day, but if things get busy, then they set them aside and focus on the voters there. And at the end of the day, they're left with a large number. But in many counties, this is the case. Many cities, this is the case. But it seems to be a particular problem in the city of Milwaukee.
Right, and the thing is, we look at these races as though they're, you know, they're like a basketball game, and the score keeps changing, and the score at the end of the game is what determines it. But it's as though the baskets were actually all scored at the same time, and we're just beginning to understand.
Right. I mean, there is a psychological element to it that creates a narrative through the night. But the fact is, everybody's votes ended at 8 o'clock, and at that time, you know, then Evers apparently won by 36,000. But it makes it more dramatic for us as we report and say,
Did you thank the county for that?
I did not. Maybe I should.
But in some ways, the city of Milwaukee was a winner because it spoke to very high absentee voter turnout, high turnout throughout the city. City Alderman Cavalier Johnson put out a statement praising city turnout this morning. It was a big push, especially after the 2016 race with the drop-off. So I think in some ways the city is celebrating its turnout.
Yeah, I think the city actually is a winner, even though they had this problem, because Walker and the city, and in particular Mayor Barrett, have not gotten along over the last 8 years. Mary writes about this regularly, about the conflict between the two. That's probably going to change. The difference in the county is that there were 140,000 vote difference between Evers and Walker's this time. In 2014, it was less than 100,000. So the county and the city both delivered. And in the city, Evers ended up getting 78% of the vote. These are things that governors are going to remember when they're deciding what to veto or what to put in their budget.
Well, were there places or demographic groups with whom Tony Evers performed better than expected, or that Walker performed worse than expected?
You know, the polls all along, the Marquette poll was showing that Evers was doing better among independents, among women, particularly college-educated women. Craig Gilbert is our expert on that. But it also looked like Walker wasn't doing as well in areas that he had, you know, performed better in 2014, where he had lost some of that support. That could have been those independents, that could have been those women. But once you start seeing a high voter turnout in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and support kind of peeling off in some of the other areas, that's really hard to overcome.
And the Walker campaign was, up until yesterday, convinced that the independents were going to break their way, because they have in the past. And, you know, in each of the three previous races, he did very well among independents. This time, he did not. In the exit polls, I think he's down 7 among the independents. And, you know, as we all know, people say this is a purple state. It's not a purple state. It's a deeply red state and a deeply blue state. And from time to time, this side wins, and this time this side wins. It's not that we're moderate. It's that you have different groups coming out in favor, and, you know, Walker benefits when these people get out and the independents join him. Unfortunately, this time they did not.
We're a pendulum state.
Right, yeah. Purple seems to imply we're moderate, but, you know, it's not moderate. It's like Tammy Baldwin and Scott Walker, both very pleasant personalities, but if you're talking about their political agendas, Tammy Baldwin slightly, I mean, she is left of most Democrats. Scott Walker is right of most Republicans. It's, you know, people frequently vote for them, and there were people who voted in this election for Walker and Baldwin.
A lot of them, apparently.
Yeah, apparently.
And I think, you know, I was polled this time for the first time in like 20 years, and while I was going through the poll, I was thinking, you know, this assumes we're rational actors, and we have a tally, and we say yes, no, and at the end we say what we're going to do. But I think frequently, and there was no real place for this in the poll that I went through, people choose who they like. And they say, Tammy Baldwin, she's a very likable person. Or Scott Walker, he is, you know, the sort of person that someone said you'd meet at a church event. But their policies don't always match up with the personalities.
I would love to have been the pollster that got Dan Bice on the line.
It's confusing because I don't vote in races I cover. So I would answer all these questions and then say, who would you vote for? And I was like, neither. And they're like, you mean undecided? No, neither.
We should talk about the Attorney General's race for a moment, because the vote totals were similar, but a little closer than they were in the governor's race. Within the margin that it would take in order to have a recall, although not an
recount.
Automatic. Recount. The number of times we're all saying the wrong thing is... Wisconsin, the state of recall and recounts. Smaller than the margin that would allow for a recount, but not so small that the taxpayers would pay for that recount. How informed are voters, generally speaking, in the Attorney General's race?
You know, it's not the top of the ticket, and I think probably the challenger, Josh Call, felt a little bit neglected compared to what kind of coverage Tammy Baldwin or the Scott Walker, Tony Evers race was getting. So he frequently was found to have a lot of voters in polls not know much about him. However, I think, again, those when we saw the votes coming in, high voter turnout in the city of Milwaukee, which leans very Democratic, he did go up on TV. So I think that those things do play a role. And a lot of people associate Brad Schimmel very
closely
with Republicans.
But I think if you walked out on the street and said, who is Josh Call, you would get a lot of confused looks still today, even though the election. But, you know, in the city of Milwaukee, the numbers are incredibly similar between Evers and Call and Walker and Schimmel. In fact, Walker and Schimmel, I think, are within a few hundred votes of each other. So the important thing to people weren't that they knew who these two candidates were. They just knew that they were both on this side of the political line.
So how does the likely prospect of a Democratic governor and attorney general affect the power dynamic in Wisconsin going forward?
I think really dramatically. I mean, I moved back in 2009, and this is the first time, you know, the first race I covered in 2010 was a complete flip the other way, where it went from blue to red. And this is, you know, obviously less dramatic with the legislature, but I think it really will dramatically affect things in Madison going forward.
I'm thinking about starting an office pool for the first time the word gridlock is used in our paper. I think, you know, that one thing that is going to be interesting is the transportation budget, because there's been a stalemate there. Walker made his name for himself in 1995 when he voted against Governor Thompson's gas tax increase and has set himself firmly against that. And Evers, you know, one thing, as a candidate, we have no idea where he is on taxes, but he seems to be open to a gas tax increase. And in the assembly, Robin Voss seems to be very interested in doing some sort of funding to pay for roads. It'll then move to the Senate, and what will they do? But I think, you know, the dynamics change. I'm not sure a whole lot gets done with the way it's set up now.
We could start seeing like a Tony Evers, Robin Voss transportation plan and them going up against the Senate Majority Leader.
Sure.
Scott Fitzgerald, yeah. Which would be interesting.
You may not know the answer to this question. I'm sure you don't know the answer to this question, but I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you anyway. What do you think the win by Tony Evers does to the Foxconn deal?
You mean, is that assuming politicians do what they say they're going to
well,
do on the
right.
campaign?
Well, right. I mean, there was a lot of talk about how Tony Evers might have done. He said he would have done the deal differently. Mm-hmm. At this stage of the game, the deal's already made. Does he have any cards to play?
I think we saw this report, which was quickly shot down by Foxconn yesterday, about recruiting Chinese workers to come here instead of, you know, and obviously there's been a big push to have Wisconsin voters working there. I think Governor-elect...
Wisconsin workers.
Wisconsin...
You said voters.
Oh, sorry. Workers, yes. I'm not thinking
I guess they're voters too, but...
Sure. I can't talk right now. But I think, you know, obviously we saw Governor-elect Walker in 2010 flexing his political muscle with stopping the train. I think Tony Evers could try to flex his political muscle in we want Wisconsin workers working here, not Chinese workers, for example.
It doesn't kill the deal. And, if somebody like Matt Flynn had been elected, then it would be in real trouble. With Tony Evers, I think, once again, like many other things with him, it's sort of squishy. You're not sure what he's going to end up doing. He might cut back on it a little bit, but I don't think it's dead. I think it'll move forward.
Well, Dan Bice and Mary Spicuzza, thanks so much. We're going to take a short break and then return with more post-election analysis.
You're listening to a special Informed Voter Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Welcome back to an Informed Voter Lake Effect recorded live here at the Collectivo Back Room. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We have a panel of guests, all of whom are checking their phones throughout this recording. And it's the one time that that's okay. We're joined on stage. Mary Spicuzza is staying with us. Bill Glauber is with us now. And we're talking about yesterday's midterm elections. And let's talk about the Senate race. You compare the margin of victory in the governor's race and, say, the attorney general's race, and it's a few thousand, which doesn't seem overly significant. But then you look at the margin in the Senate race, and it is really substantial. What do we know about why either Tammy Baldwin connected so strongly with voters or Leah Vukmir did not?
Tammy Baldwin ran a relentlessly focused campaign, a very good campaign. She started early, got ahead of some events, and really just put together what you have to would call a textbook campaign.
And in comparison, Leah Vukmir?
Leah Vukmir had a tough time. She had a fight in a very difficult primary against Kevin Nicholson, a U.S. Marine veteran. She ended up emerging from that primary around August 15th. She did not have enough money to compete in the general election. She raised about $5 million. Tammy Baldwin has raised more than $29 million. It'll be 31 when all is said and done. Money matters.
Right, and this layperson's view, the Vukmir ads all but disappeared from the airwaves in the couple weeks leading up to the election. National Republicans had seen the writing on the wall, would you say?
I believe that's what happened. You know, Vukmir was double digits behind in polls for weeks, was not getting into the race, and you have to get into the race to have that outside money pour in because people have to take their resources. They put them elsewhere.
It also seemed like Leah Vukmir ran a really different campaign than Scott Walker. Scott Walker was not talking about Trump all the time when he was out campaigning. She really embraced, she got on the Trump train, as Fitzgerald would say. And so it was definitely noticeable. And again, we saw in polls that both Trump and Vukmir were struggling among independents, among women, particularly college-educated women.
I think the two people who ran the most centrist campaigns in this race were Tammy Baldwin and Scott Walker. They were the incumbents. They ran to the middle, and they were quite effective. Walker, despite his loss, ran quite effectively given what he had to navigate.
So, Bill, do you think that accounts for the people who voted both for Walker and for Baldwin?
They are known quantities, known brands around the state. People generally, if they like them, like them. And, you know, you can disagree with Scott Walker. I know there's a lot of animosity toward him, but he comes across and is a very likable person. The same with Tammy Baldwin. You can disagree with her, but she is a very likable person. Tammy especially was very underrated coming into this race by some Republicans. Those who knew her, though, knew that she would be a formidable foe.
So would you say, is this an informative race then for people who are thinking of trying to run statewide in Wisconsin? Dan Bice a few minutes ago talked about the likability factor. Do you have to be a certain kind of candidate to win a statewide race in Wisconsin versus the kind of candidate that runs in an assembly or a state senate race?
Are you asking whether it's somebody that you could have a beer with in Wisconsin? That's
exactly what I'm asking, yeah.
You know, I think regardless of people might criticize Walker's love of summer shandy and things like that, which he doubles down on, but he is, if you talk...
He did go out for donuts yesterday.
Okay, yes. But if you talk to him one-on-one, he is very good about talking about the Packers, talking about a controversial play, he can talk about things that are not just politics. So he will talk Packers, he will talk Brewers. He's kind of comes across as like a Wisconsin dad in a lot of ways. So I think Tammy Baldwin also comes across as a likable, personable person on the campaign trail and can connect with voters one-on-one.
This is purely a hypothetical, but would you have imagined that the race would have looked different had Leah Vukmir not won the primary election?
So you're saying if Kevin Nicholson had been in the race, it would have looked different, but she, again, you underestimate Tammy Baldwin at your peril. She defeated Tommy Thompson in a race where she was the underdog. She came into this cycle as a relative underdog, given that the state had been won by Donald Trump. But she has a formidable campaign team behind her. She follows the message, and she ran it right through the tape. And Leah Vukmir never got close in this race.
I was trying to remember, what was Tammy Baldwin's margin when she beat Tommy Thompson?
I believe it was +5.
With that latest poll showing how many voters were concerned about health care and coverage for pre-existing conditions, I mean, Tammy Baldwin, how long has she been talking about health care and pre-existing conditions? That is a huge issue for her.
That is a huge issue. She was talking about it long before national Democrats. You know, as you got into the final weeks of this race, Democrats around the country were talking about this issue, but Baldwin was talking about it a year ago.
Things did not change at all in terms of the makeup of both the Assembly and the State Senate and Wisconsin's congressional delegation. Is there any way to have a conversation about those races without talking about the nature of how districts are drawn in the state?
Republicans actually picked up a Senate seat,
right?
Didn't they? I think, as we were live tweeting the results, we saw a lot of responses about redistricting or gerrymandering concerns. It is interesting when you see a wave where Democrats are winning every statewide seat and then Republicans holding all of the districts. It is interesting. I mean, it's, clearly it's the same voters, but we do have ticket splitters too of people who like a candidate and they might be a Walker, Baldwin, Dale Cuyenga voter. It's like...
And what people don't consider about gerrymandering, yes, it locks in the majority, but it also locks in seats for the minority. I don't think people like politics or politicians that much. So for all of the incumbents to win must say something about the system we have.
As we're having this conversation, I am looking at Twitter, and apparently Brad Schimmel has sort of conceded. His quote is that while the results are not final, it appears that Josh Call has won this race. Let's talk about some of those down ballots. We talked a few minutes ago about the AG's race, but Democrats also won the Secretary of State's race, and they won the state treasurer's race too. Is this a Trump vote? Is this a coattails for Baldwin vote? What do we know about how people vote in those kind of lesser known races?
We know it's tough to beat Doug LaFollette, that's for sure.
And Sarah Godlewski?
Yes, and Sarah Godlewski, she, you know, do you want to weigh in on
No, this? No, I was just going to say Tammy Baldwin's coattails, I think, probably pulled everybody else across the finish line for the Democrats. She ran tens of thousands of votes ahead, and it's very hard when the top of that ticket is running so far ahead for others, you know, in the opposing party to gain traction. So I think she could, you know, rightly say right now that she, by the election, is the most popular politician in the state at this moment based on these results.
How do we square Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson representing the same state in the same body?
That deeply red and deeply blue with not so much purple. Yeah, I think, I mean, we swing back and forth and...
They're both good campaigners. Ron Johnson broke the mold. He was down in 2016. He just said, the heck with it. I'm getting rid of my consultants. My brother and I are going to make the commercials. And he convinced people that he had a message, that he had opinions, and that he had interests outside of politics. And that's what the voters responded to.
And sometimes voters might get frustrated with who's in the White House. And I think we've heard a lot about frustration with Donald Trump, and that's going to favor Democrats. Not to take away from the candidates, because obviously they ran strong races. And
right. What about business in the state going forward for the next 2 years, where we have kind of the top is Democratic, the assembly hasn't really changed, we're still dealing with that split. How much do we think is going to get done?
You know, it's so brand new. I don't think anybody knows. In the old days, there would have been agreements. You know, we've had parties where the governor is one party and the other party controls the legislature. But we have not had this in this sort of era of two parties completely split apart. Obviously, the key players are going to be Evers, Voss, and Fitzgerald. And they will have to either come to some sort of agreement or remain at loggerheads. So there could be, as Dan Bice said, gridlock. There could be some deals made. Who knows?
Mary Spicuzza, what do you know, given how power is divided up in Madison? What are the ramifications for what the district maps will look like in elections to come?
You know, I think Democrats really regretted not going for nonpartisan redistricting when they had the chance, when they had control of the legislature. It will be interesting to see if they continue to push for that, since they have been doing since they lost control of the legislature, and I think realized how they really didn't fare very well in the latest redistricting round. So, you know, there's lawsuits over redistricting going on right now.
The courts drew the maps here for three cycles when there was split government, so you could expect that to happen again. I don't know what will be the effect of that, but that's what you would probably expect going forward, unless they can cut a deal.
Now, Dan Bice has left the stage, but he was talking about his winners and losers list, and he lists, I believe, Paul Ryan as a loser, despite the fact that his seat that he's vacating went fairly strongly to Brian Stile. Where do you see Paul Ryan in the dynamic of what played out on Tuesday?
We get to talk about Bice now that he's not on the stage anymore to defend himself. In some ways, you could say that Paul Ryan is a winner, and I haven't read his column yet because it just posted while we were up here, but... you know, Paul Ryan is not going to be the minority leader, which he, you know, with all the seats lost, that's a tough role to play in D.C. That's not a fun seat to have necessarily. And so he got out. His former staffer is taking his place. He's still quite young and has a career ahead of him, I'm sure. He said that he's not planning to run for office, but
he's
as
said
we
that
know,
before.
Yes. As we know with politicians, plans can change. So he, mm-hmm. He is not exactly of retirement age, although he is technically retired.
I'll give you two words. Nancy Pelosi, she didn't quit when she lost the leadership. She's hung in there, and she is probably going to be the Speaker of the House again. That's a long, lengthy career, and that is going with the political sea changes. Ryan got out. I think he has to be judged on that measure.
The Democrat in that first district race, Iron Stash,
Randy Bryce.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people, a lot of Democrats nationally that placed a lot of stock in him, and he was able to raise a ton of money. What went wrong for him that he lost by 10 percentage points?
He faced an uphill battle in that district. It's been Republican leaning. It had gone for Ryan, very big, Walker, Trump. So there was that. He also faced about $2.6, $2.7 million worth of attack ads from the Congressional Leadership Fund. Paul Ryan endorsed Super PAC. And those attack ads were frequent, and they talked about his 9 arrests. He tried to present himself as just, working class fighting for workers, but seeing 9 arrests splashed over the screen, questions about his debts, those were personal attacks, and that's hard to overcome.
Do you think the Democrats might have vetted him better, knowing that those things were in the background?
His primary opponent, Kathy Myers, certainly said that she would be a stronger candidate, that character mattered, and that she would be the one who could withstand attacks, or I guess not have as many attacks against her. Democrats were very, very enthusiastic about him, though, and really backed him. So, I think vetting is a question that is going to come up in a number of these races, and especially we might even hear about things that we haven't heard about yet of people.
Brian's style got better as a candidate as this race went on. He was an effective communicator, and, he obviously won it fair and square, and he was just the better candidate in the end.
Well, and we look at the Democrats that have run in that district, and there are really a lot of kind of novice candidates, which I think it seems speaks to the fact that there just aren't a lot of prominent Democratic politicians in the first congressional district.
Right, and clearly Randy Bryce did a lot better than other Democrats who have made a run, and he was able to raise a lot of money and get a lot more votes than most Democrats there, but it was going to be an uphill battle.
And
I think he was the underdog.
If Democrats want to do better in this state, they're going to have to get in the game in the district around Racine, up in Brown County, and up north where Dave Obey was. You can't keep giving up these races, losing by 10 points, and expect to do well in every statewide race.
Well,
they've talked a lot about their thin bench or trying to build their bench.
So do the statewide victories for Democrats build some kind of momentum for Democrats that infuses the races 2 years from now, do you think?
Well, if we've got an attorney general who's, in his 30s and has a statewide seat, I mean, that's building the bench, trying to get more. Also, Mandela Barnes, young candidate, first African-American lieutenant governor in the state, second elected to statewide office, I believe.
A party can't consider itself truly statewide if it overperforms in two urban areas and underperforms in many other areas of the state. They need, obviously, the bench and to go further outstate.
That's Bill Glauber and Mary Spicuzza of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thank you to both of you. How much sleep are each of you operating with?
About 3 hours.
About 2 hours.
All right. Well, together you have 5 hours of sleep, so it sounds pretty good to me. Thanks to both of you, and we'll be back with more of our live Lake Effect post-election special in just a moment.
You are listening to us on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Welcome back to an informed voter live Lake Effect from Colectivo's back room on Prospect Avenue. You're listening to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. We're talking about yesterday's midterm elections with a cast of thousands this morning. joining us on the stage right now are the Journal Sentinel's Craig Gilbert and Mordecai Lee, who longtime former state legislator and longtime professor of government at the UWM School of Continuing Education.
Very good.
I did that from memory. Thanks to both of you for being here. You guys are like the uncounted ballots in Milwaukee County. let's just start with kind of going over what we've been talking about for the past 40 minutes or so. Does this kind of square with where you are as well? What are the big takeaways both across Wisconsin and nationally that you see from yesterday's races?
Well, nationally, this is kind of the world of modern politics that we should be getting used to by now, where you have two parties that are very competitive with each other. They're very far apart. And when the people elect a president, a new president, and give that new president monopoly power, then at the first available opportunity, they take it away. And that's one thing that happened last night. It's happened over and over again. And in Wisconsin, you know, Wisconsin just keeps swinging. I mean, it's as much as you can talk about all the changes in politics over the time I've been, 30 years I've been covering politics. I mean, so much has changed. We're so much more polarized. We're so much more partisan. The media is different. You know, everything about campaigns is different, but what the common thread is that Wisconsin just swings election cycle after election cycle, and every time you think one party is gaining control and Wisconsin's becoming a red state, it goes blue, and you think it's becoming a blue state and it goes red. And that, I don't see that ending anytime soon.
Although one of the trends that surprised me, Craig, you've written about fewer and fewer ticket splitters. Yesterday, there was a chunk of ticket splitters.
There was in relative terms, but you know, if this election had taken place 10 or 15 years ago, we would have thought very little of the ticket splitting. It's only by sort of the modern day standard of basically no ticket splitting. In fact, if you look at the exit polls, it looks like about, I think, 12% of the Walker voters voted for Baldwin. So that would be about 6% of the electorate are Baldwin Walker voters, and then a much smaller number are Vukmir Evers voters, but it's a total of about 7% that's actually splitting their tickets between these two races. It's not really a lot, but it's more than the 4 or 5% that we saw sort of in 2010, 2012, 2014, 2016.
So is Wisconsin an outlier when you put it in the context of national politics, or did the results we saw last night in Wisconsin kind of square with everything that, you know, there was a lot of talk about a potential blue wave. It's unclear whether there was a blue wave or what it looked like. Did Wisconsin's results look really substantially any different from any place else?
Well, I think there are some long-term demographic trends going on in Wisconsin. You see that in Wisconsin. I mean, we saw a continued softening of Republican support in the suburbs. I mean, we saw it. Where did Donald Trump underperform Mitt Romney in 2016? It happened in Ozaukee County and in Waukesha County and in Dane County at the other end of the spectrum. Where did Scott Walker lagged the most behind his performance in 2014? It was those same places. So you can see some signs of those very, very red Republican suburbs getting a little less red. At the same time, you've got the Democrats' problems in rural Wisconsin. There were counties where Scott Walker continued to perform well. On the other hand, Tammy Baldwin also performed well in these places. So there are some demographic things going on that are also happening in Wisconsin, but then there are also some regional trends around the country. We saw what happened, you know, the famous blue wall, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where Donald Trump flipped states that had been voting Democratic for president. Well, what happened to that blue wall? Those blue wall states last night was they flipped back. That didn't happen everywhere. I mean, you had very disappointing for Democrats, a big Democratic disappointments in some other states.
I'm starting to wonder if it was that additional layer of voters who did not turn out 4 years ago, but voted yesterday.
So 4 years ago or 2 years ago?
4 years ago.
Okay.
So in other words, 4 years ago, about 2.5 million votes, Walker wins. Last night, I haven't seen the final numbers, maybe 2.6.
More than 2.6. Close to 2.7 at this point.
So in other words, there's a layer of voters who 4 years ago did not vote and voted yesterday. And when you move down the demographic spectrum in terms of age and education and income, these people skew Democratic. So the Democrats were more successful at getting out their vote, getting new voters who otherwise wouldn't have voted. I think that was their secret of success.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just remarkable. If you just take the two big Democratic counties of Milwaukee and Dane, I mean, it's mind-boggling. I mean, 4 years ago, the Democrats had a 100,000 vote margin in Dane County, and that seemed like a really, really big number. Last night, it was 150,000 votes. That's the Democratic margin, not the number of Democratic votes in the governor's race. Milwaukee, it went from basically 98,000 4 years ago, the margin, to 140,000. So that's massive in both those places. And again, it's, you know, both parties have kind of a fatal flaw here. I mean, the Democrats have a narrow geographic base, and they have trouble you know, broadening that base into the rural areas and small towns, but then this massive math problem for Republicans when Democrats generate those kinds of numbers out of the two most populous cities and some of their surrounding suburbs in a statewide election. It doesn't help them for the legislature because it's in those two places, but in a statewide election, that's really, really hard to overcome if you're a Republican. I mean, to find those 90,000 votes or whatever it is in the small towns around the state.
Right. You remember when we used to talk about soccer moms? For some reason, soccer moms has dropped off the agenda. It doesn't fall off our tongues. But it could be that the soccer moms, the college-educated
Has soccer moms been replaced by Me Too?
I think soccer moms are merging with Me Too. And it's the college degree that's sort of the entry requirement. And so if Scott Walker couldn't count on the soccer moms of Waukesha County as much as he usually could, then that's Wisconsin joining the national trend.
What about younger voters? There was a lot that I read about that younger millennial and younger voters were coming out in force to register and vote for the first time. And I happened to witness that at my polling place. I voted early and saw a lot of people who were probably 18 years old who were registering. So what effect did that have?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't kind of gone deep enough into the numbers yet. And sometimes it's hard, that analysis is hard to do. I mean, but one note about what we just talked about the education gap, which again is a widening gap. We saw it in a big way in 2016, and we've seen, you know, voters splitting both along gender, but especially education lines over President Trump. And one of the groups where Scott Walker lost a fair amount of ground in this election was college-educated voters. He actually won them by a point 4 years ago, according to the exit polls, and he lost them by 13 points last night. So that's a big deal. At the same time, on the other side, you look at the Marquette polling, it shows a long-term bleeding for Democrats among men without college degrees. That's actually a much bigger group than women with college degrees. I mean, the non-college vote is bigger in Wisconsin considerably than the college vote, and so that's a problem for the Democrats, and sometimes those things are going to offset each other.
You know, Bonnie, generally speaking, the propensity to vote, you can predict it based on age. The older a person is, the more likely they are to vote. That's why seniors have so much political influence. It could well be that perhaps younger voters turned out a little bit more than average than they would. But, you know, there's so much churn when it comes to young voters. Every 2 years, every 4 years, UWM flips in terms of its student body. So you can see long lines of people registering. That doesn't necessarily mean that youth of that age group are really turning out so much more than, say, the national pundits were predicting.
The poll, the Marquette University Law School poll, which was sort of famously off 2 years ago, was spot on this time, almost within a percentage point of being right in both the Senate and the gubernatorial races. Are we better at understanding public opinion? Are people being more honest with us?
Or are
we just lucky? Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the poll was spot on in both the Senate race and the governor's race. It was also spot on about the fact that there were, according to the exit polls, there were roughly equal numbers of Democratic and Republican voters last night. And some of the other polls that had a bigger lead for Tony Evers had a more Democratic sample. And so Marquette hit that right. And that was the key thing, as it turns out. The polls aren't perfect. They're never going to be perfect. The best polls are always going to be off some years. And
but if you're Charles Franklin, you have to be taking a victory lap this
totally.
Morning.
I mean, you can't do any better than that.
And especially because when you talk about the margin of error of a 47-47 race could just as easily have been a 52-42 race. So he really did nail it. I think with the changes in the electorate, if almost half the voters voted before Election Day, polling can get better because you can start capturing that whole audience.
The other thing is it is easier to poll in a state like Wisconsin where so many people vote. I mean, if you think about a low turnout state, it becomes harder and harder to figure out who's actually going to vote. But if, 60% of the voters are voting in a midterm, which is almost like more than presidential level in some states, again, the turnout extraordinary, almost 60%. That was higher than the national presidential turnout in 2016. And so then, when everybody's voting, it's a little easier to try to capture what's going to happen on Election Day.
Mordecai Lee, what do you think the path forward is on new district maps? Because that's going to potentially be a fairly significant shift in the next couple of years.
Well, it really comes down to if a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature decide that the way forward is paralysis and let the court do it, or if the way forward is to compromise. I think compromise is always the better option politically. I know I sound like an old fogey. When I was in the state legislature, half a loaf was better than none. But it seems to me that for Republicans, it would be logical to say, if we do a nonpartisan redistricting, we can protect ourselves from the uncertainty because we don't know what the court would do. And possibly in the long run, we'd do better. So I think there's a chance that reapportionment would work. But generally speaking, it seems to me that the politics of last night, in terms of Baldwin being this giant killer, is just astonishing. First, she beats Tammy Thompson. She's the first gay member, lesbian member, for Wisconsin, it was a shrug. And then 6 years later, we started seeing negative TV attack commercials against her last year, and she was able to withstand it. So I think she's an underappreciated politician. And in terms of Scott Walker, I think his biggest blunder was Foxconn. Scott Walker is a fabulous politician. He has a fingertip feel for politics. The day after Foxconn, he said, I can't imagine anybody's going to be against it. Didn't he say something like they can go suck lemons or something like that?
How did you see Foxconn playing out statewide?
Foxconn was a liability for him. And so he moved to the middle, but he couldn't get rid of Foxconn. He couldn't get rid of pre-existing conditions. So whatever Democratic pollster discovered pre-existing conditions, that's the wedge issue of this year, in the same way that Republicans have always been successful finding wedge issues against Democrats.
I think actually you could argue that Scott Walker's biggest mistake was running for president. He put himself in a hole in terms of his approval ratings that he had a very hard time digging out of, particularly with independent voters. He never really recovered with them. It kind of reinforced, the challenge that any politician who's been in office for a long time faces, which is just this idea that you're a career politician. He's run so many times throughout his career. I mean, I think every other year of his political career, he's run for office. And so it reinforced that problem. And it also meant that if he had any thoughts about kind of zigzagging to the center, particularly after the recall fight, he was eyeing a Republican presidential campaign in which he was going to be appealing to conservative voters in places like Iowa. And so he didn't kind of make those moves to the center that he tried to make this year, maybe too late.
Now, Scott Walker's kind of signature piece of legislation early in his first term was Act 10. Clearly, the legislature is still in Republican hands, but what does the future of organized labor look like in Wisconsin with a Democrat in the governor's office?
Well, presumably what we're going to be seeing is that Governor Evers is going to maximize his executive ability to promote unions.
What is that authority?
God beats me.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I've got tenure. It's okay. But in the same way that we've seen presidents exploring the maximum executive powers that they can, maybe about DACA, will it work? Will it not work? Will immigration reforms? All the executive orders we've been seeing on the federal level, I think we're going to start seeing these kinds of executive orders on the state level.
We have just a few more minutes, and I wanted to kind of pull the lens back a bit and talk about what the Wisconsin results look like with the rest of the national results. There were some interesting governor's races that were won and lost on both sides. We have some interesting, the House of Representatives has flipped. Craig Gilbert, from your position, what does all this portend for the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, one thing is to think about the next presidential race and what it means for the electoral fight. You've got some states that seem to be slipping away from Democrats and toward the Republicans, like even in the Midwest, Ohio and Iowa are getting harder and harder for Democrats. But then those blue wall states came back for Democrats, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Democrats had a big Senate victory in Nevada. They're doing well in Colorado. They're doing great in Virginia. But then they suffered big losses in Florida and maybe in Arizona. So there's a lot of cross currents in the map, and it's going to be really interesting to see, given the sort of suburban metro versus rural kind of demographic divides we're seeing right now, how that plays out in the next presidential campaign.
You know, as the electorate becomes more majority-minority, theoretically, Democrats should be looking forward to that. But I think Republicans are so good at politics, so good at campaigns, so good at wedge issues, that I think they're going to be holding off the tidal wave for several more cycles.
Would you imagine that we are going to start seeing the 2020 campaign ads in the next couple months?
Didn't one appear about 5 minutes ago? I think they're just waiting at the starting line. They're just dying to start.
Honestly, given how late things ran last night, had you ever seen anything quite like the way the governor's race played out in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, you know, we had a state Supreme Court race in 2011 that was kind of reminiscent of that,
where only Waukesha County
a bunch of votes in Waukesha County instead of Milwaukee County seemed to tip that race. We've had, you know, this is the fourth time since 2000 we've had a result, a super close result for a major election. The other three were the presidential elections of 2000, 2004, and 2016. They were all decided by less than a point. So it's not that novel. I mean, there was some soap opera drama last night because of the timing of how the votes were counted, but this is who we are.
Okay, can I go to sleep now?
Yeah, exactly. I think we all need to hit the snooze bar a couple of times before we next speak. Well, suffice it to say, we'll have plenty to talk about for the next couple of years. Mordecai Lee and Craig Gilbert, thank you so much. You have been listening to a special Informed Voter Lake Effect broadcast live from the back room at Colectivo on Prospect Avenue. Thank you so much to the staff here and to our Journal Sentinel colleagues, including Craig Gilbert, as well as Mary Spacuzza, Dan Bice, Bill Glauber, David Haynes, as well. Also to our guest, Mordecai Lee.
Thanks also to WUWM staffers Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, Lauren Sigvison, Christine Lamatina, and Jason Reavy.
Thanks so much to our studio audience here and everyone listening and tuning in on both the radio and the Facebook live stream.
This wraps up our special Informed Voter Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.